Call from mom. Answer it. Call silenced.
Instacart knows nothing gets between you and the game. That's why they make ordering from your couch easy. Stock up today and get all your groceries for the week delivered in as fast as 30 minutes without missing a minute of the game.
You have 47 new voicemails.
Download the app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network, from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with three lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.
This hour of the Mark Reardon Show is sponsored by Gamma Tree Experts. Your trees deserve the best care. Call Gamma Tree Experts.
The owners of this country know the truth. It's called the American Dream, because you have to be asleep to believe it.
I'll lead an effective strategy to mobilize true international depression.
Mark Reardon.
So in the words of my late friend Aretha Franklin, show some R-E-S-P-I-C-T.
This is the Mark Reardon Show.
Hey, welcome to the Mark Reardon Show. Brad Young sitting in today with you till 6 o'clock. Buckle up, folks. We've got lots of stuff going on today. And in fact, anymore, is there ever a time when there isn't a lot of stuff going on? Those days are gone. Normally, I'm the legal analyst both on Camo X and now on KFTK. And in fact, Mark Reardon gave me the official title of the 97.1 FM Talk legal analyst. And that and $5 will get me some coffee favorite coffee
place. I'm surprised you get $5 out of it. Usually there's no compensation.
No. I said with $5 I could get a cup of coffee.
Got it. All right.
No. So, but I get to hang out with the cool kids today. So thank you. Speaking of cool kids, Sue Thomas, great to see you.
Nice to see you, Brad.
Dave Klein, thanks for piloting the show here today.
Absolutely. Happy to do it.
Did either one of you watch the Bezos launch?
Loved it.
Yeah.
Pretty cool, huh?
It was really cool. Yeah.
Did you watch it, I assume?
I did. I watched the whole thing. I was late getting into work because I wanted to watch it. Mm-hmm. And but I was struck by the fact that it seemed like a Six Flags ride.
Yeah.
Because you wait for hours and hours. The ride lasts 4 minutes, you know, and then it's over.
Well, you're right. I mean, it lasted, 10 minutes and 10 seconds?
Yeah, but they only had like 3 or 4 minutes of weightlessness.
That's true.
So that to me was like the Screaming Eagle. I guess the only difference between this and Six Flags was there was no giant turkey leg in the space capsule.
Right. If I'm Wally Funk, I'm telling Bezos, like, listen, you said this would be 11 minutes. There's only, 10, 15. So can I get a few million dollars back?
That's right.
We didn't really get the whole 11 minutes out of this.
Yeah, it was rather short. But I looked it up yesterday. 200,000 people signed the petition to ban Jeff Bezos from coming back to Earth after he went into space.
Why? Why are they so mad? I don't get it.
Oh, because he's just a hated figure because he's worth $200 billion.
Oh, well, good for him.
Oh, I know. But I think he really is just one fluffy white cat away from being a James Bond villain. I mean, he's...
Looks-wise,
money-wise, he's got his own rocket company. You know, that was the movie Moonraker,
right?
The Bond movie Moonraker.
Oh, yeah, I forgot about that.
You know, the plot was a billionaire industrialist builds a space station and then takes all the pretty people up into space with them so he can destroy the Earth.
They have to be somewhere, Brad.
I know they do, but I mean, it's almost like, life follows art here if he did stay up in space. But at least 200,000 people signed the petition. I didn't, but
and he caught a lot of heat the other day when they were doing the interviews post-trip.
Yeah.
Right, after they returned.
And he said, I want to thank all the Amazon customers because you guys helped me do this. I went up in space because of you. And of course, the Twitter mafia, which goes after everybody, said, oh, how dare you, Bezos.
Well, that's how he made his money. I'm always annoyed. I'm like, well, that's how he made his money.
He didn't make his money out shoveling snow or something. I mean, this is how he did it.
He started in his garage. He made a lot of money.
Good
Hooray!
For him.
Yes.
Right. Good for him.
And the website's come a long way from what it used to look like.
Oh, is that right?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, Amazon, you mean? Yeah. I thought you were talking about another. Yes.
No.
Yeah,
yeah.
Totally agree.
So I'll never take that away from the guy. It's pro-capitalism.
Exactly.
Oh, I 100% agree, and I'm glad he's got the money to do it. I just think he needs a better PR person. And if you think about it, the first thing he did when he came back, he knows he's got a PR problem. First thing he did was he donated $200 million to charity.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And that's going to give him about a day and a half of PR, and then people are going to start hating on him again because he's a billionaire.
Right.
Well, he did that immediately after, while the people were signing the petition to leave him in space. So, you know.
And I'm sure everyone's saying, like, but only $200 million, Jeff. Really, couldn't you get more?
Right. Yeah. There's never.
You can afford it.
Right. As if $200 million isn't enough.
Right.
And, it's for him. It's like 1% of his net worth, but still, it's $200 million.
It's a lot of money.
It's still, you can buy a lot of stuff with that. The other thing I wanted to ask you guys about as the show's kind of getting started here today is the Olympics. You guys excited about the Olympics?
Love it.
Very excited. Hoping it happens. I'm kind of worried about that.
Well, you know, even as of this morning, the head of the Olympics in Japan would not rule out the possibility that the Olympics would still be canceled.
At the last second.
I think it's kind of remote.
Yeah.
But still, he was kind of giving himself some wiggle room here to say, well, we still may cancel it, which is really patently absurd.
Mm-hmm. Yes, it is.
And all of the efforts they're going to keep everyone in the bubble, trying to keep them safe. I mean, I know some members of our Olympic team have tested positive, but every single case, they've just tested positive with no symptoms.
Right.
These people have worked so hard.
Oh,
they couldn't go last year.
Right.
Then you get an additional year tagged onto that. You're that much older. You have to keep up. Gosh, you got to keep yourself interested for a whole another year. And most of them are there already, are they not? I mean, it starts tomorrow.
Yes.
I think it's like some of the competitions actually started even before tomorrow.
Well, the women's soccer team started yesterday.
That's right, yeah.
And I'm going to bring this up with Kevin Wheeler in the 5 o'clock hour, but I keep hearing about the women's soccer team losing 3-0 yesterday against Sweden. Now, I don't know if this is true. I'm not trying to spread any rumors here, but I did hear a rumor that the U.S. women's soccer team is boycotting the scoring of goals until all racism is defeated. Now, again, I don't know that there's any truth to that, but they're just boycotting the scoring of goals.
It's going well so far.
It really is.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, the 3-0 against Sweden, you know, and next week they'll be playing against the Vatican. You know, it'll be a bunch of really old nuns that they're going to be playing against, and we'll see if they still keep up that scoring, goal scoring boycott.
They'll still find some excuse.
Well, it is kind of a round-robin thing, so it's not like that they're out of the contention for the gold.
Right.
But it does look bad when you're expected to be the powerhouse.
Not a great start.
No, it's not a great start. I mean that would be like if the men's basketball team, you know, lost to Norway in basketball. I mean, there would be some questions that have to be answered if you lose to Norway.
Right, right.
So we'll see. I'm sure it's going to work out better. The other thing that's just briefly in the news today is that the White House is weighing more mask mandates for even vaccinated Americans. Now, how does that make any sense?
It doesn't. Not at all. Not at all.
It doesn't make any sense to require it, other than, and I heard he was... he was part of the CDC, but it's not Walensky, but it was someone else. It was with the CDC, I heard yesterday, say, well, the purpose for wearing a mask, if you're fully vaccinated, isn't to stop or block the transmission of COVID. It's because other folks don't know if you're really vaccinated yet or not. So it was a tacit admission that it's really just for appearance sakes.
Of course.
That you're wearing this mask. It's not going to do any good. And yet now we're seeing this pushed. Now, legally, the question becomes, can the federal government require masks? Can the federal government require vaccinations? Even today, the White House said that they are looking into ways to require vaccinations. Now, I'm fully vaccinated, I got my first shot at the first week of March, drove down to Sikeston to get it because you couldn't get it here then. And I enticed my wife to go get the vaccine with me by saying, we'll stop at Lambert's for some throat rolls.
Oh, that's a good idea.
And she said, I'm there. Let's go. So we got
a shot and a roll.
A shot and a roll. That's exactly right. Better than, you know, like in Washington, you get a shot and a joint in the state of Washington. But no, not in Missouri. You get a shot and a roll at Lambert's. So that was fun. Even though I'm fully vaccinated, the question becomes, can the federal government mandate or require vaccination? And that is an unknown legal issue. Dave, do you think that's something the feds should be able to require? Because employers can, but should the federal government force you to get it?
I don't think so. No. I would hope people make the right, responsible decision, but I would never mandate it.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's interesting. There's a case from 1905, Supreme Court case. It's called Jacobson versus Massachusetts. And in that decision, the question was whether or not Massachusetts could require smallpox vaccination.
Hmm.
And the U.S. Supreme Court ruled that the state, not the federal government, but the state could require it under the police power. But here's the difference between that case in 1905 and today. It's this. The fine, if you didn't get a shot, there was a $5 fine in 1905, which, you know, would be a little bit more money than that today.
Sure.
But it wasn't like there was two people showing up at your door, you know, wearing white shirts with short sleeve white shirts and riding up on a bicycle to your door saying, we're going to hold you down.
We got the needle already.
We got the needle. We're going to give you a shot. You know, they were doing that. It was a $5 fine.
Yeah.
And so that case was upheld. But if the question becomes, can the feds or even the state government say, you must, as a citizen of this state, have a vaccination, boy, we're going to see litigation like we've never seen before.
Oh, yeah.
And this case from 1905, I see it's being touted a lot as justification for saying, well, the states can require it. But all they said was you could require a $5 fine, which is different than saying you can be forcibly vaccinated. I mean, yeah, to me, that's like the cases, and there was a whole string of cases that came out in the 70s, you may recall, where prisoners were being sentenced, particularly people who were convicted of rape or sexual crimes, were being ordered to undergo chemical castration.
Really?
And that was ruled... That was ruled to be unconstitutional, that the state couldn't forcibly chemically castrate a person for committing a crime. And even though obviously chemical castration and a vaccine don't have the same outcome, but conceptually it's very similar, forcing you to take something as an injection.
Right.
And those were all ruled to be unconstitutional. So we're going to see how this plays out, but I just don't see any way that the federal government can forcibly make someone sit down, take a vaccine, and get it. And then the flip side of that is that, you know, with the vaccine, there's a federal law been in place for years that prevents individuals from suing vaccine manufacturers if they have an adverse reaction. So they're immune from liability. Now, there's a fund that's out there, and I looked this up the other day. In 20 years, I think there have been less than 50 people who have actually collected from this fund. So it's extremely hard to get compensation if you have adverse reactions to a vaccine.
Interesting.
But you can't sue the manufacturers. And the idea is that, well, if you could and you put them out of business, then it would jeopardize the health of the nation. So by federal law, you cannot sue a manufacturer of a vaccine. But if New York gets its way, and we're going to be talking about this as the show unfolds today, if New York gets its way, you can sue gun manufacturers, even though there's a federal law that prevents that as well. Ugh. Mark Reardon Show here this afternoon. Brad Young in with you with Sue Thomas and Dave Klein. Thanks for sticking around. We'll be right back on 97.1 FM Talk. Welcome back to the Mark Reardon Show. Brad Young in this afternoon. And before the break, We were talking about why there are not any lawsuits against manufacturers of vaccines, and that because under federal law, the feds do not want frivolous lawsuits to put vaccine manufacturers out of business. But isn't that the same business model that the Democrats are trying to employ right now to attack the gun industry? So to break this down, I reached out to Amy Swearer. She's a legal fellow at the Heritage Foundation, the Meese Center for Legal and Judicial Studies, and a frequent writer at DailySignal.com, which is a website I go to literally every single day. Amy Swearer, thanks for joining us this afternoon on 97.1 FM Talk.
Thank you so much for having me.
Hey, you wrote an article this week at the DailySignal.com on why government shouldn't go after a lawful gun industry. But before we get into all of those details, set the stage for us on, first of all, the steps that the state of New York has literally just taken recently to target, and I use that term on purpose, to target gun manufacturing industry.
Sure. So we even need to take it a step back further and sort of lay the groundwork. So in the early 2000s, Congress passed a law called the Protection of Lawful Commerce in Arms Act. And essentially what it does is it prohibits not lawsuits against the gun industry wholesale, but it prohibits people from attempting to sue gun sellers or manufacturers for crimes committed by third parties. So you can't just sue a gun manufacturer because they, you know, lawfully sold a gun to someone who then went out and committed a crime. You can still sue them, you know, for normal, what we'd call like civil tort claims, like if a gun explodes in your hands,
sure,
for advertising. And so what New York has done is essentially take their state consumer protection laws and broaden them in such a way that essentially everything we don't like that we think is bad now violates consumer protection status, which then it sort of gives a workaround to sue the gun industry by saying, oh, well, it violates the state consumer protection law, even though it violates it in a way that is, you know, supposed to be protected technically under the Protection of Lawful Commerce and Arms Act. So it sort of like creates this loophole to get around federal law to open up potentially a lot of these same types of frivolous lawsuits that are designed to sort of try to hold the gun industry accountable for criminal actions by other people. And even if they don't, it kneecaps them by sort of hampering them down in these you know, slogs of lawsuits that, you know, they still have to go to court to get them thrown out. So that's sort of where we're at with what New York has done.
To what extent could federal preemption here come into play, since the federal government has already instituted a law, and you even referenced it with regard to the 2005 Protection of Lawful Commerce in Arms Act? Does federal preemption apply here?
Well, so theoretically it should, but again, what New York has done is essentially take one of those exemptions to that law. So again, you can sue the gun industry if they violate state consumer protection laws. And they've said, okay, well, then we're going to rewrite our consumer protection laws in such a way that basically gun industry bad, sue them. It's more of a complicated interaction than that. But I mean, at the end of the day, what New York has done is try to work its way around that very protection that Congress, essentially to undermine that protection in a way that Congress did not intend.
We're talking to Amy Swearer. She's a legal fellow at the Heritage Foundation Meese Center for Legal and Judicial Studies. She's also a frequent contributor to the DailySignal.com. And it's interesting, Amy, as I was reading Governor Cuomo's statement whenever he was signing this into law, he referenced the fact that, and of course this is false, but he stated that only the gun industry has blanket immunity from litigation. And I thought, well, first of all, that's just false. You've already explained why that's false. But it's really the reverse, isn't it? I mean, if these lawsuits can go forward, gun manufacturers could be sued for third-party liability that no other manufacturer has to defend. I mean, for example, if I buy a soccer ball and I use it to, in an illegal fashion, to kill someone with a soccer ball, there's no way that someone could sue the manufacturer because I used the product illegally and contrary to its intended purpose. And yet, isn't that exactly what New York wants to do with this new gun law?
Right. I mean, the gun industry is in a uniquely political situation where, you know, you're right in saying, you know, there has never been this slate of lawsuits against the soccer ball industry, you know, for lawfully selling their product in a way that there has been for political purposes against the lawful gun industry. This is actually in part why this 2005 law exists, is that prior to that, what a lot of gun control advocacy groups would do is use this as a tool to, again, just sort of kneecap that lawful industry to bog them down in expensive lawsuits. Exactly.
It worked. Colt Manufacturing had to stop or threatened that they were going to have to stop making pistols altogether because they were having to deal with all of these frivolous lawsuits.
Right. And that was, again, that was the purpose of these lawsuits, was not because there was any legitimate, you know, legal liability there, but because it was just to make it very expensive for them to operate. And again, so you're right in saying we don't see these, none of these other industries have this sort of protection, but it's because you don't have political groups going after those industries in the same way that you saw for the gun industry.
We're talking to Amy Swearer, legal fellow at the Heritage Foundation, frequent writer for DailySignal.com. And I want to move from the state level to the national level, because you just given an excellent explanation as to why this law is a bad idea in the state of New York. But isn't this exactly what Democrats want to do on a national level?
Well, I mean, this has sort of been the policy underlying, you know, most gun control advocacy. It is essentially, you know, how do we make it harder for the gun industry to operate, and therefore, how do we make it harder for law-abiding, ordinary, peaceable citizens to get their hands on firearms, which are, again, lawfully, constitutionally protected under the Second Amendment. So I think you're right that this is sort of the underlying strain of most, if not all, gun control advocacies. How do we increase those barriers? How do we make it so expensive? I mean, even when you get down into, you know, the case that is now before the Supreme Court about good cause concealed carry permitting, you know, where we're just going to make it so expensive and so difficult to get it that most people can't, in fact, do it. I think you're right. That is the underlying premise for most of this, is how do we make it more expensive? How do we make it more complicated? How do we make it more difficult?
Mm-hmm. And if Democrats increase their razor-thin margins in the House and the Senate in the 2022 election, I mean, isn't the Protection of Lawful Commerce and Arms Act of 2005 going to be a prime target if the Democrat majorities increase in the House and Senate?
Well, I think it would certainly be one of several prime targets in sort of the Second Amendment realm. I think you'd see that. I think you'd see some sort of universal background checks, possibly a reinstitution of the 1993 quote unquote assault weapons ban that expired in the early 2000s. So I think you'd see a lot more, again, things that are fairly common at the state level in terms of, you know, gun control advocacy pushes. But I think you'd see a lot of that have a much more significant chance of being passed at a federal level.
And what's interesting about the article that you wrote, Amy Swearer, for the DailySignal.com this week, was that you didn't just focus on why this New York law is bad, but you also discussed the good parts of why people are gun owners and why it's beneficial and how we don't hear much about it. Because, you know, we are flooded with news coverage every time a police officer is involved in a shooting, but you know, we rarely, if ever, hear of the countless times that law-abiding citizens use their firearms in self-defense. So how often does that actually happen, since we certainly never hear about this from the mainstream media?
Yes, I think it actually shocks most people to find out that, you know, according to almost every study that has been conducted on this issue, you're looking at about 500,000 to about 3 million defensive gun uses a year in America. And that's not a number I just made up. That
Wait,
is a number
say
that was
again.
Actually
I'm
reported.
Because that number just flows over people. Say that number again. This is per year.
500,000 to about 3 million times. And I think on average, it's probably more realistic about a million times a year. And again, that's not me making this number up. That is according and verified by a 2013 report by the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, which is not, as we know, exactly a pro-Second Amendment, historically pro-gun group.
No, they are not.
You know, and what I'll say, you know, some people say, oh, well, there's some other studies that show lower numbers. There are two outliers, and even they have it at around 100,000 times a year, which is still, I think, far more than most people anticipate when they think about this.
Right. And of course, we hear about it from the mainstream media, oh, like never. You know, so that's what's astounding. If you've got one instance of a police officer involved shooting, it's the lead story. Here you have perhaps a million instances a year where people use firearms to protect themselves, and it's rarely, if ever, reported.
Right. And so this is something we've been trying to do. We actually have a monthly series with the Daily Signal where we highlight, you know, just from the past month, a dozen or so instances that if you, you know, blinked on your nightly news, you may have missed it. But it's part of our broader defensive gun use database, which, again, we link to in this story. You can visit it online if you just go to Heritage Defensive Gun Use Database, where we, you know, go through thousands of articles from, you know, the past year or so that you probably missed. There's an interactive map. You can see what's going on in your neighborhood and in your state. And I think it's a great tool. And again, even that is just a fraction of the number of times we know that this happens, because most of these are not even going to be reported to the police, much less, you know, find their way into the nightly news. So just a tip of the iceberg. But even that is well worth looking through and understanding just how important that right to keep and bear arms is for peaceable citizens.
You know, one of the things where we're located here in St. Louis, Amy, obviously we broadcast and cover a very large area, which includes large sections of both Missouri and Illinois. And there have never been two states that are more divergent when it comes to gun laws between Missouri and Illinois. And so this, to me, is an issue that's amazing, because you're demonstrating at thedailysignal.com just how often firearms are used to protect lives, to save lives, and we're really not hearing that anywhere else.
No, because it's often, you know, that it's the story that doesn't happen. You know, it's the murder, the homicide, the armed robbery that's stopped, where a lot of times that's actually less of a story. You know, it actually in this set, we have, you may have missed it, on June 21st out of Arvada, Colorado, an individual, a armed Good Samaritan with a concealed carry permit, who stopped what would have been a mass shooting of police officers, stopped that. And yeah, it made some news, but not nearly as much news as it would have made if, you know, you had a dozen dead police officers. And so I think that's part of the problem with this is, you know, that the act of defending yourself often gets much less publicity than if you fail to defend yourself. And that's unfortunately just the way, you know, large-scale media works.
Well, kudos to you and thedailysignal.com for particularly for covering that angle of this story, Amy, because we only hear one side of the story, and I think that creates a biased sensation for folks who just only see the negative side and fail to comprehend why, in fact, the Second Amendment was placed in the Bill of Rights. Amy Swear, if folks want more information about you, the Heritage Foundation, or the Daily Signal, how can they find you online?
Well, you can always follow me on Twitter at Amy Swear, or if you go to heritage.org or dailysignal.com, you'll see a lot of both my writing and then writings from a lot of my colleagues, also covering a wide variety of topics. But you can always find me there as well.
Amy Swearer with the Legal Foundation, or the Heritage Foundation, rather. Thanks so much for joining us this afternoon on 97.1 FM Talk.
Thank you for having me.
My pleasure. Hey, when we come back, more computer hacking in the news. So we reached out to our favorite expert when it comes to cybersecurity, Nick Powers. He'll be joining us right after this on 97.1 FM Talk, The Mark Reardon Show. Don't go away. Welcome back to The Mark Reardon Show. You know, this week, we've heard a lot more stories about state-sponsored cyber attacks. And specifically, both the United States and the European Union have accused China of hacking a Microsoft email server as part of a state-backed campaign. And it's really adding, I think, to growing claims of Chinese involvement in high-profile cyber attacks. We've heard a lot about Russia. Now we're hearing more about China. So to help us understand what this latest cyber attack means technically as well as practically for you and perhaps even your business, I reached out to cybersecurity expert Nick Powers, vice president of the technology consulting firm Uncommon, which is based at Scott Air Force Base over in O'Fallon, Illinois. Nick Powers, thanks for joining us this afternoon on 97.1 FM Talk.
Hey, great to be back, Brad. You know, I've been on vacation for a few weeks and all this stuff's, you know, spinning up and the president's making addresses to the nation and everything else. This is an incredible time. And so I'm great to be here. Great to be here with you today.
See, you can't go on vacation, my friend. We can't afford you to leave and be on vacation. Look what happens when you're gone.
It's incredible, that's for sure.
It is. A few weeks ago, the cyber news was really focused on Russia's involvement with ransomware, and that's still in the news. I mean, even today, we've gotten some more news about that. But this week, now we're hearing about China's involvement in hacking the Microsoft Exchange. So let's first lay the foundation, Nick Powers. What happened from a technical perspective as it applies to the Microsoft Exchange server?
Yeah, so essentially back in January, a firm was able to identify hackers penetrating different Microsoft Exchange servers. So Microsoft Exchange is a software product that you install on a server, and that actually actively manages your email capability. In some cases, companies install it themselves and manages it themselves. But in other cases, as in the case of my company, we actually contract Microsoft to host Exchange servers on behalf of us and manage all the email for us. And in some cases, that's very cost effective, especially for small businesses. And so it's really the wave of this is how most businesses run their companies is they do this with the Exchange servers. So essentially what happened was hackers were able to identify what we call zero-day vulnerabilities. And there's been up to four of them now have been attributed to what's happened. And these zero-day vulnerabilities are bugs in the code. It's not specifically that they were able to inject information or code into the source. It's that the Microsoft developers made mistakes. And so they identified four of these mistakes. And as a result of these four mistakes, they found ways of penetrating into Microsoft Exchange and were able to get into email servers without even using a password.
Wow. And when you mention this zero-day exploits or zero-day vulnerabilities, you can actually – there's a market for these, isn't there? I mean, aren't these things like the zero-day exploits are auctioned off on the dark web when someone discovers these vulnerabilities? People can go and just – it's just like an auction where you're buying a car, but you're buying literally vulnerabilities in source code.
Yeah, I mean, there's a number of – nefarious things that happen on the dark web, but yeah, they do have auctions for this type of information. In other cases, they just put it out there as, hey, you know, if you want to know about this stuff, pay me $1,000 and I'll give you this entire information package. And people can use that to go exploit these zero days for sure.
So what does this mean from a practical perspective? I mean, you've talked about how there were four of these zero day exploits that someone got and it allowed them to get access to the Microsoft Exchange server. But what does that mean practically for someone who uses Outlook or if their company has their email service managed by Microsoft? What does it mean for them practically?
Yeah, so this is something that I'm also trying to wrap my head around a little bit too, because one of the things is they haven't been very forthright with exactly what zero days were impacted, right? Because they're trying to minimize people knowing what they could do to exploit. But Essentially, Microsoft has been putting out a series of patches over the last several months to fix these zero-day vulnerabilities. So once those patches are installed on your Microsoft Exchange server, and or in the case of my company, Microsoft's already installed that in the managed servers that they provide in Office 365 and so on and so forth, that means they are no longer vulnerable. Now, what the Chinese hackers are being accused of doing is getting in, using those exploits to load up other software on these servers. So even if the vulnerability was patched, they can still maintain access to your mm-hmm. server, spy on you. Essentially, so there's, you know, we talked about this a little over a month ago, Brad, which is there's two kind of motivators going on right now. What we've seen from the Chinese side of the house is they're very motivated by intellectual capital, right? They want to know how to build the next generation fighter. They want to get knowledge on our latest and greatest technologies. They don't want to destroy. They don't want to hold people for ransom necessarily. And so we're seeing them mainly spying on different, you know, company networks. So they would be using these exploits to get software in place to spy on people. You know, conversely, the Russians typically have been known for destroying with ransomware and then holding people for ransom. So
isn't that interesting, that the focus of these state-sponsored or at least state-approved hacking are so different. Their goals are different. One is just basically holding you up for cash, and the other is stealing intellectual property.
Yeah, it's really interesting. And what we're seeing is potentially tens of thousands of companies are impacted by this.
And we don't know who all those are yet, because as you say, the information about this has been rather slim in terms of them being forthcoming.
Right. Exactly. So, you know, if you listen to one of the former members of the Department of Homeland Security, Chris Krebs, who's an expert on this type of stuff, he's an expert on, you know, nation state attacks and whatnot. He basically said, you know, if you used Exchange and in between, you know, January and March of last year, you should just automatically assume you've been hacked, and you should be taking measures to monitor your email traffic, you know, put security controls in place to make sure that somebody can't impersonate you. That's something else we've seen before, where once they get access to your email accounts, they actually send emails on your behalf and ask for money or wire transfers and things like that. So, you know, basically telling you to start putting in measures to monitor and make sure that, you know, nothing bad happens.
And I want to talk about those in just a moment. We're talking to Nick Powers, Vice President at Uncommon, which, of course, is a technology consulting company based at Scott Air Force Base over in O'Fallon, Illinois. And I want to come back in just a moment to that particular issue. But before we get to that, I want to get your opinion on this, Nick Powers. Just last week, a British think tank stated that the United States was by far the most cyber-capable nation. So do we have capabilities as a country to help defend our nation against these cyber attacks?
You know, I feel very confident that we have a lot of capability here in the United States. I mean, with our work with the Department of Defense, you know, we've seen the scaling up of our cyber defense capabilities for the DOD. Now, but therein lies the issue, right? Is you know, we are a country where you don't typically have the military intervene with, you know, normal culture, day-to-day life, private businesses. You know, there's kind of always been a line drawn there, and there's laws and regulations around, you know, not having the military interact, you know, on our soil in these types of situations. So that's an interesting question, because it becomes a question of, you know, where does that capability lie? Do we have enough in the private industry to do it? Or really, is it a military function? And in that case, can it really help private industry? Can it really help private citizens? That's
hey,
a
Nick,
question
we're
that I don't
up
have
here
an
on
answer
the,
to.
We're coming up here on the clock here. And if folks or businesses are concerned about this hack and what they can do about it, how can they find you?
Yeah, we're at uncommon.com, uncommon.com. And, you know, feel free to reach out to us, and we'll be happy to help.
Great. Nick Powers, hey, thanks for joining us this afternoon on 97.1 FM Talk.
Thanks, Brad.
T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network, from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with 3 lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.
Protect your vehicle's engine with a full synthetic oil change and save with Mobil 1 at O'Reilly Auto Parts. Purchase 5 quarts of Mobil 1 full synthetic motor oil and receive a $10 O'Reilly gift card after rebate. See store for details. With your Mobil 1 purchase, you'll also receive 2x points during O' Rewards Bonus Points Month at O'Reilly Auto Parts.
Oh, oh.